Hi, this is John Moore, and welcome to my New Year's Day podcast. My guest today is Pam Pierce. And Pam, I want to welcome you to the microphone.
Thanks so much, John, for having me.
Pam Pierce is the daughter of very famous, at least in my neck of the woods, the Texarkana area, and then much later he became famous all over the world as a director, Charles Pierce. So tell us about your dad, who he was, the first movie that really set him off to his trek to and through Hollywood, Pam.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting about you, John, is I saw that you had met him previously as Mayor Chuckles when he had his Laugh-A-Lot Club. So he started out actually in television. He was born in Hampton, Arkansas, a little big town. Started out in television and radio around El Dorado, Monroe. And I believe by 1960, he already had his first television show. So I know that my mother was a guest on his show. And by the time that I was in the second grade, when he started working on Boggy Creek, he had a kiddie show, and he was on the local NBC affiliate growing up in Texarkana in that region. And then he starts an advertising agency in Texarkana, and he does work for all the big businesses in town. He has the bank, and he has this trucking company, Ledwell & Sons. So at some point in time, he decides to make a movie. And he wanted to make a Western. He had always been influenced by Ford. And so he was going to do a Western at first. And I'm coming across this now. And they were going to name it Bright River, I believe. So he had met Earl Smith at a party, and Earl had written a couple of Westerns before. So my dad tells him that he wants to do a movie. Anyway, they go to Los Angeles. They're looking to cast it and to raise funds. And they see these kids walking down the street in Los Angeles saying something about protecting the Falk monster or something to that effect. Anyway, they're in California, and they pull over and they jump out and they start asking these kids about their shirts, and they basically, my dad looked at him and said, "We're making the wrong movie, let's go home." And it started out as tracking actually the Falk monster, and then it became The Legend of Boggy Creek. So he's known kind of as one of the first independent filmmakers, and The Legend of Boggy Creek became a cult classic.
I grew up in the Texarkana area during the 1960s, and to reference the show that you mentioned, there was a local program in the 1960s. A lot of television stations produced their own local children's program, and KTAL produced one called the Laugh-A-Lot Club. And I went with my Cub Scout troop, and we were on your dad's show. In, I guess it would have been probably around 1968, 1969, and that was the first time I met your father. And then much later, after I went into the radio business, I reconnected with your dad through KTFS, which is a radio station in Texarkana. Jim Nicholas, Dave Hall, Dave's no longer with us, but they were friends with your dad, and I reconnected with him. He was working on another movie in the early 1980s, and that's how I got back in contact with your dad. But the significance of The Legend of Boggy Creek is not to be understated. I think that I've forgotten the exact number, and maybe you know this, Pam. It was, and maybe still is, the most profitable independent film that was made. Is that correct, or has it been surpassed by Blair Witch?
You know, I've heard things back and forth. I know that it's held a lot of records. Just recently, I was told that it held the record for a long time, and it may still hold a concession, that the theaters did record numbers in concession. And so we were kind of laughing, saying, "Was it from people jumping up and spilling their popcorn all over?" I'm not sure. I've heard that. I've heard Paranormal Activity had come up and hit close to those numbers and stuff. But, you know, it was at the beginning of the entire independent film movement, so things were done so much differently, and that's what kind of sets Boggy Creek apart is that it really did stay separate all of this time. So they made their own rules in a lot of ways. They set up their, in fact, you know, I mean, they literally were pioneering and doing it as they went.
Our guest today on the podcast is Pam Pierce. She is the daughter of Charles B. Pierce. What does the B stand for, by the way?
It stands for Bryant, which was his mother's maiden name. My dad was actually related to Bear Bryant, if you can believe that. He was they like double first cousins, and it may be down the line, but the Bryant family in Arkansas, he came from that family. He went by Charles Pierce until he was making the film, and he went to Los Angeles with my mom, and I believe that they were staying at the Riot House, or the Hyatt on Sunset Boulevard. I used to call it the Riot House. And downstairs was appearing Charles Pierce. And my dad was super excited. He's like, let's go. We have to go see. Let's go see Charles Pierce, right? And they went down, and it was a female impersonator. And being from Texarkana, I got a huge kick out of that. But he added the B then to differentiate himself, because there was actually a Charles Pierce that was a performer that was actually fairly well known during that time. So the B he added, and that is from the Bryant family. So Charles Bryant Pierce.
Talk about the legend of Boggy Creek and the genesis of it. The film industry is much more difficult now, I'm sure, than it was then, but it still had to be hard. He had to raise the money. What was the budget for the film? Who all did he get to act in it? How did he get the script written? Just talk to us about how the whole thing came together.
I believe my dad kind of went around to everyone, all of the businesses in Texarkana, and was hitting them up for funds to make this movie. And I was told that at first, his original budget, he said $25,000 he thought he could make it for. And he pitched it as a small regional film. And so he had always been influenced, as I said, by Ford and the big screen epic kind of movies that he had grown up with watching. And then he liked things like the Wild Kingdom, Disney's Wild Kingdom, and Marlon Perkins and all that kind of stuff. So it was surprising how much he did not know. He had his experience in the advertising with the cameras and stuff. He was lots of energy. He was a hard worker. He was quick on his feet, kind of a bit of a MacGyver. He would maneuver things around to get them done, whatever needed to be done. And he, in The Legend of Boggy Creek, he played most of the roles, including singing one of the theme songs. So there's a whole thing about that, but I remember being in the second grade and him telling my mom, I overheard them talking, and he told my mother, he was asking my mother if she had heard these stories about this creature that had attacked this man or whatever. And so my mom was just, I could tell that my mother didn't really say anything, but I remember my dad telling her he was going to make a movie. And then the next thing I remember, he was sitting on the floor with a camera that he had borrowed, and he had the pieces all around him, and he had the instructions, and he was putting it together.
Just starting from scratch to do this.
Absolutely, he was. He did convince Mr. Ledwell to put up the money, and they ran out the first week.
They ran out of money the first week. Who is Mr. Ledwell? Tell us who he is.
So Mr. Ledwell was L.W. Buddy Ledwell. And he had this trucking company called Ledwell & Sons. And my father did these beautiful commercials for him. They built big rig custom, you know, trucks and fleets and all that kind of stuff. So my dad would do these beautiful commercials for them. And so I found out now that Mr. Ledwell actually owned my father's advertising agency. So anyway, but he goes and he pitches it to him, Tommy Clark, who was became his business manager later, but was the president or VP CFO, something like that, at Leadwell, general manager, something like that. He was the, you know, kind of face of Leadwell there. He told me that he remembers Mr. Leadwell coming around the corner and pointing and saying, like, basically, follow him. He's costing me way too much money. And so Tommy was writing the checks. Tommy told me that they really did it almost at the beginning as a regional, I mean, as a hobby. I'm sorry. It was a hobby. And they really, no one ever expected it to make any money. So my dad, the only other theater was the Oaklawn Cinema there, and then there was the Paramount Theater, which had closed. And my dad contacted the Paramount and asked them to, if he could rent it out. We all went. He got his brothers and friends, and we cleaned the theater, the Paramount. And then he had his world premiere, and everything changed after that. Like, everything, our whole lives, everything changed after The Legend of Boggy Creek.
For those who are not familiar with the Fount Monster and the entire premise of the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek, which, what did that come out, 1972?
It did. It premiered August of 72, and it went into a full release in 73.
For those who aren't familiar with it, the Fount Monster is basically Bigfoot, is what most people think. And the town of Fount, Arkansas, which is in the southern part of the state, not far from Texarkana, is supposedly the sighting, many sightings, of what is called the Fount Monster, Sasquatch, Bigfoot. I have to ask you, do you believe in it?
I do. I have to. I think it's a creature. Like, my dad didn't call it a monster, and I wouldn't call it a monster. I think that it's some sort of animal creature that we just haven't discovered. For a long time, Boggy Creek was out of my life, and I didn't really, it's such a part of my life. I had seen it so many times growing up, and it was just in my DNA. And so as I grew up and moved away and started a family and had kids and all that kind of stuff, I didn't follow Boggy Creek anymore, really. I didn't keep up on it. And in that time, this entire field of, like, cryptozoology has grown up, and, you know, I mean, all things have happened, and so there's a lot more, you know, people talking about it now openly. Back then, it was kind of taboo, and it was embarrassing, and people would make fun of you and tease you, and you didn't talk about that. If you did, people thought that you were a drunk or that you were mentally ill or you were trying to get attention. Or, you know, I mean, just, I don't know, but it was kind of frowned upon. And now people talk about it, and it's out in the open, and it's, you know, it's kind of an accepted thing. And so I've been studying it and watching these things and catching up on all things The Legend of Boggy Creek. And Lauren Coleman, a cryptozoologist that has a museum in Maine, pointed out that the giant squid was called the Kraken, but they didn't, no one really knew, you know, it was talked about, and it was this thing of lore, but it wasn't really known to exist until they finally started washing ashore, and it was the same thing with the panda bear. So, you know, we think that we know everything, and then there are these vast regions that we really don't know anything about, so... Yes, but there's something in there. I think that too many people are seeing it, and too many people that really are genuine and sincere, and it changes their life.
So your dad believed in it?
He did. He did. He heard it. He and Earl Smith recorded the scream, the famous scream, and I don't know if that's the only time that they heard it, but he definitely heard it. He was in Falk, in that area. He was down in the bottom somewhere in that area.
Was he there trying to catch it for the film, or was it later?
Well, I remember the night that he was going out with Earl to catch it, and I asked him the next day if he had gotten it, and he said he did, and he was super excited. And I don't know if that's the only time. I recently spoke to Travis Crabtree, and Travis told me that the night that all the hunters had the dogs and they were tracking it, that they heard it that night, that it was ahead of them, and it was crying out that night, too. So I'm not sure. I'm going to ask him more and see if I can get more clarification. But I know that it was, he told me that he heard it the night he was going out to record it. So I don't know if that's the same night that they were recording, that they were filming the dog thing or not. But
our town, I grew up in Ashdown, and our town got Falk Monster Fever after the film came out. It's very difficult to explain to someone who wasn't around when this movie came out how big of a deal The Legend of Boggy Creek was. This movie, you said the budget was $25,000. What was the final amount that...
It says recorded $160,000, so that's what I'm going to go with. A lot of it was at the end, though, was they gave him some credit, I believe. He got two-thirds of the way through the budget, and then he had to go for post-production work in Los Angeles. And that house, which is Jaime Mendoza Nava, he was the composer, but he also he arranged for a lot of other stuff, too. And so I believe that they gave him credit there. So all told, I think it was $160,000.
But the movie made way more than $160,000. How long did it take for him to make his money back?
It was almost immediate. Well, I mean, it was the minute it premiered. The thing, too, is when it premiered, like I said, people were embarrassed about those coattails and stuff like that. So it was a little bit, it was playing in the rundown theater. It wasn't playing at the Oaklawn, the nice fancy theater where The Godfather played and, you know, those kind of movies. So it was a little bit frowned upon. And then all of a sudden, it just, that night after it premiered, it just, the word of mouth exploded, as you were saying. It was almost like a phenomena. It was just, it blew up. It was just, my dad, I remember everybody talking about it, and the lines would just go, and people literally would bring sack lunches, and they were sleeping in line, and so it sold out as it was called then, now it's the Perot Theater, but it sold out for the first 6 weeks, I believe, and then shortly after it started to play, though, he had enough money for a second print. When he came home from Los Angeles, he came home on a Greyhound bus, actually, with one print and the poster art, the Ralph McQuarrie poster art, which is, I think, a very important equation into the whole phenomena that is The Legend of Boggy Creek, is the poster art of the creature going through the swamp was painted by Ralph McQuarrie. Who in 75 goes to work for George Lucas and creates everything Star Wars. He first creates the 21 storyboards that accompany Lucas scripts, Star Wars scripts to 20th Century Fox. Lucas had been turned down by the other studios, and so he was offering them to Fox. And he asked McQuarrie to do these storyboards to go along. Of course, they give him a green light. It is said that Chewbacca was inspired by the Falk Monster. And if you look at the elements, you'll see that. My dad comes back from, Ralph McQuarrie, that's his first professional work. So my dad comes back with that work and a print of the movie, cleans up the theater. Literally, we were, it had closed, so it was one of those theaters where when you walk through, your shoes were sticking. You had to make sure that they didn't come off your feet. So we really had to clean it. And then the lines, just like I said, so my dad immediately, within just a few days, my dad bought a Corvette, because that's kind of who he was. And I have two siblings, I'm the oldest. And so he would stuff us in the back seat of the car, and my mother, and he would say, let's go see how rich we're getting. I know that's crass, but that's actually what he would say. And he wanted to go see the lines. And so we would go, and he would just, he would drive and just, oh, he would be so happy, just almost dancing, you know. So shortly after that, he got a fingerprint, which I have recently read was a reject. That there were some faults with it or something, and they gave it to him. So he puts that print at the Strand, and in the same newspaper articles, we're pulling them all now for a bonus reel that we're working on. So this should be covered in the bonus reel that we're working. But it says that he made $55,000 in the first few weeks at the Paramount and $45,000 at the Strand. And that was tickets at a dollar. It was Four Walling. So Four Walling was where you would rent the theater, and you're responsible for all that stuff. And so we would go to Shreveport. We would drive to Shreveport, and he would have to wait to a certain point in the movie before they would release a box office receipt. So I don't remember what point that was. Let's just say it's three-quarters of the way through or whatever. But we would get there, and we would have to wait till that point, and then they'd give him the money. He would put it into paper bags, and he bought a gun. That was one of the, he bought a gun in that car, and he would stuff the money under the seat of the car, his, you know, the driver's seat with his gun, and then we would take off that. And I remember it would be late at night. And I remember always that we would be driving over Boggy Creek. If you went from Texarkana to Shreveport and back, you passed Boggy Creek. So that was, it was, I would fall asleep. It would be school nights and stuff. So I would fall asleep in the back of the theater while we would wait for that point in time. But it was cash money. And I was just told recently that it was, in another go-round, I guess it was Texarkana, Shreveport, El Dorado, and Monroe, and that track on a weekend would gross $40,000, and the tickets were a dollar a piece, and so they would count out dollar bills. Every once in a while, he told me that there would be a 5 and a 10, but mostly they were $1 bills.
Our guest on the podcast is Pam Pierce, daughter of Charles B. Pierce, the writer, director, actor in the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek, approaching 50 years old now. It's hard to believe. Part of the reason that we're talking with Pam is because Pam has just finished a huge effort, or is close to finished, I'm not sure, you can correct me if I'm wrong, of restoring the original print. Talk about that process and the process of you actually getting the rights to the film and then restoring it.
Well, for years, people have wanted a good print of The Legend of Boggy Creek. I would, I didn't really know it so much. I mean, I think feel it, and I didn't really see a lot of bootleg in the decade between. I know that there were VHS copies out there, but I didn't see them too much. It wasn't until the early, like, 2001, somewhere around in there, my husband was an early adopter of the internet, and he had been working with the internet for a long time. So he had this whole thing set up, and my kids used it all the time. I did not ever go there. I just didn't go there. So finally one day he had it all set up, and by that time they had the search engine, Ask Jeeves. So he set me down and he said, just search the net. You'll have fun. Whatever. And it was still early though. Not a lot of websites. They were more like chat rooms and stuff. And so the first question I asked is, who is Charles B. Pierce? And when I did, up popped, it was shocking almost how much was on there already and pretty much saying the same thing. And I wish somebody would go back and get the right clears and give us a good copy of this. So I called my dad And my dad was going through a difficult time. A lot of artists, they have their ups and their downs. And so I called him, knowing that that my dad no longer had the right to the legend of Boggy Creek. But I asked him, I said, and I never asked my dad personal questions about those kind of things. Those were touchy subjects. And I just didn't ask him about his personal business or his finances or any of those kind of things. But I knew that he was struggling a little bit. So I called him up and I said, Dad, this thing called the internet, have you ever heard of it? And he was like, yeah, I think so, a little bit. And I said, well, it's like the library on steroids, you know. And I said, what happened with Boggy Creek? And I said, tell him to take it back a little bit. And I said, let me just read you this, and this is why I'm asking you. So I started reading him all the time. It's like, somebody needs to go back. And he was like, he just started laughing. He said, well, that's exactly what I would do. So I said, I traded Mr. Ledwell, that's Buddy Ledwell, his money man producer, the legend of Boggy Creek, and Bootleggers for Winterhawk, which Winterhawk was his third film. So I said, well, you need to go back and talk to Mr. Ledwell and get those rights back and re-release it. And he said, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And so shortly after that, he would call me, and he was all happy, and he was saying, oh, guess what I'm looking at? And so he had Boggy Creek in Walmart and in Sam's Club. And I didn't, I said, you should put those big, you should do a big end cap and cut out the, you should put the McQuarrie image, cut it out on the end cap. And I said, you'll sell out. And he said, oh, no, I don't need that. That's too expensive to do that. And we're doing just fine selling them like this. Well, then in 2010, my father died. He had been sick for a long time. He had Alzheimer's. I'm not going to get into all the specifics right now, but his will was circumvented. We were kind of left, my brother and I were left scratching our heads. And like I said before, I had children. I have a husband who has his own business. I stay very busy on my own. You know, I knew that my dad had struggled, financial struggles, a lot in his life. So, you know, I just let it go. And then my brother started calling me, and he was upset. And I'm the oldest, I think I got to that, and I was always the big sister. And so he ends up finding a will. He finds an original will. He and a cousin on my dad's side are in our mom's house. Our mother's house had, my sister and I had signed over it over to my brother for him to be there. And so there were a lot of issues with the house. And part of what had been my mother's room, the ceiling had collapsed. And so there was some water damage, and they were back there cleaning it up, and they had big trash cans. And my brother's scooping it up, and he throws it into the trash. And my cousin Tony says, Chuck, you can't just throw these papers. There might be something valuable in here. You gotta look at this stuff before you throw it away. And my brother's like, nah, it's just old papers. There's nothing in here. And Tony reaches into the trash can and pulls off the top an envelope, and he says, no, here's something from an attorney's office, and it's never even been opened. And so they open it up, and that's the original will. And the will had been made a part of my mother and dad's divorce decree, actually. And so my mother was to actually inherit everything. So my mother ends up dying. My mother actually died 6 months. She's buried 6 months to the day after my dad died. Okay, it's real kind of the coincidences and the timing and the circumstances of the story are really astronomical. But my brother finds this will. He sends it to me. I actually receive it on my mom's birthday. I received it in 2013, March 1st, 2013, in the mailbox. And so I opened it up. I read it. The first part of it deals exclusively with where my father wants to be buried. He wants to be buried next to his beloved wife, our mother. And I realized that I had actually paid for my dad's funeral, and I realized that I had paid for him to be buried in the wrong place. And so I kind of went into a little bit of a tailspin. It was very upsetting to me. So I put the will away again and didn't touch it for months. I was also having some health issues and stuff like that. So I put it away. And then once again, I'm reading these cries from fans, but now we've got the internet and it's in full blown. You can just read it. Yeah. It's like not, you don't have to, you know, it's not just chat rooms. You have the full blown internet. And so I'm reading the same thing, but now people are asking for Blu-rays. Yes. And so under the assumption that my father had done the deal, the Cheesy Flicks deal, I called Mr. Ludwig. So it was the first time I had ever spoken to him since, pretty much, I guess I filmed my scene, I'm in the movie, and up in the third grade, and had not talked to him all those years. So I found out at that time that my father actually had never come back. He had just gone as his own, as a producer, director. So, and I also found out that everything that has been released since 1975 was either unauthorized or outright bootleg. At that point in time, I asked Mr. Ludwig if I could do it, if I could bring it back. I said, if I can find good elements, will you let me re-release it? And he said, yes. He said, run with it. And so it's funny because I couldn't run. I had just had major surgery, but I was kind of in an invalid state. But I did. It gave me time to start researching, and I started. I was like in this bed recovering, and I started digging and digging and digging, and we started looking for the elements. And so that's a whole separate story, but that's where it started. And so Mr. Lynn will. I did find the elements in last. All throughout this whole thing, I really feel like I was led. There was a point in time, I remember the room where I was at, and everything was like, call Mr. Ludwig now. I had not really pre-planned what I was going to say or anything like that. And I was really just trying to find out information. And, yes, I wanted to go forward with a Blu-ray. That's what people wanted. And I wanted to make a bonus reel. And I knew some people that knew the Ludwigs. And so even though they had stepped away so many years before, I just felt like maybe the time was right. And indeed it was, you know.
So who owns the rights to the film now? Is it you?
So I own the rights now, yes. So it turned out that Mr. Ludwig had owned full rights for the Legend Box and Bootleggers all those years. And then when I was able to find the elements and we sent them and they were going through restoration, and I live not too far away from Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And I had met him several times, and we had talked about Boggy Creek, and I knew that he was a fan. He knew my dad. And so when the time came to transfer the copyright, I reached out to Ken Burns, and he referred me to his intellectual property attorneys. And that copyright looked really scary, but it actually was not scary at all if you knew what you were looking at. And the key always was held by Mr. Ludwig. So, and, you know, I don't know why my dad didn't go back to him, but he didn't.
So you own the rights to the film. Is the restoration complete, or are you still working on it?
It is. It's almost complete. We went to the George Eastman Museum, and they were putting on the last, the copyright warning, the legal notices, the G rated, you know, that, that screen. So it was just the legal notices. And then I will go one more time to watch it in full and sign off on it. But it's pretty much done now. They've done a wonderful job. The, Kyle Albert, who is the colorist there, and he runs the restoration and remastering services. They also have a school, and he's in charge of the school. And he told me that they just watched it in one of their big theaters there in 2K with the students. And the students were critiquing it not as a film, but as the restoration work. So they literally were going through each, you know, each part of it. And if they saw anything, they were, you know, making notes. And so it is just, it's so beautiful. And I'm going to say this again. I said it in my first interview, but if you did not see The Legend of Boggy Creek in its initial theatrical release, you've never actually really seen The Legend of Boggy Creek. Because there are elements of the film, such as the technoscope and the cinematography and those kind of things, that were lost in those bootleg prints.
Talk about casting the movie. This is sort of going backwards, but a lot of local people, you were in the movie, your dad was in the movie. I actually knew some of the people that were in the film. How did your dad just go around town and say, hey, I needed somebody for this part. How about you?
He did, really, pretty much, yes. And he always did that throughout his films. He would put his friends in there. He would put his banker or his accountant or whoever in there. He had great fun with it. But when I was speaking to Travis recently, he was there from the very beginning. He said that he remembers Earl Smith and my father coming down, and he said that my dad reached out to his father, Smokey, first, because Lynn, the older brother, had actually seen the creature on the property when he was, I guess, about 14 years old, and it had been in the newspaper. All the accounts that my dad based Boggy Creek on were based on newspaper accounts, or then he goes to Falk, he searches Crabtree out, and then Smokey then takes him down into the bottom, introduces him to people that have actually had encounters, and then the ones that wanted to appear in the film were, and then others. So Travis Crabtree, the part that he plays, even though they call him Travis Crabtree, that's actually based on his brother Lynn. But Lynn didn't want to be in the movie, and he didn't want his name used. So it became Travis. So they would move things around. Mine was, I guess they were just shooting that day, and they needed some kids. And my dad said to my uncle, go pick her up, go get Pam from school or whatever. So he would just cut. And my mother, that's my mother playing Bessie Smith. So I'm in the scene playing in the bean field. We run inside and say, Grandpa, Grandpa. And that's my mother. That's Steve Ledwell's house on the Ledwell farm. And I'm pretty sure we shot that early in. And then, but he would use, my brother is the little boy running across the field. My sister is in the Ford scene. So, yeah, he would use whoever, people that were interested in, you know, and then, you know, you have people around in the area that like to, that are theatrical and that kind of stuff. So you had those kind of people volunteering. And so he just cast like that.
So the movie is going to, what would you call it? A premiere, I guess, even though it's been seen before. It's a premiere of the restoration version. When is this going to take place and where?
So we premiere Friday, June the 14th at the, it was the Perot, but now it is the, I mean, it was the Paramount, but now it is the Perot Theater. And we won't have to clean it up in the early, I guess, when was it, in the 90s maybe? They restored it, and now it's the Perot Theater, and it's just so majestic. It is so beautiful. So it's going to be super exciting to return there. That weekend, June the 16th, is Charles B. Pierce Day in Texarkana, Arkansas, and Texas. So that'll be kind of fun, and we're planning these other festivities around it. We have a virtual race that we're working on, and the guys that do the Texas Bigfoot Conference are going to host a conference in Falk at the same weekend. So people are going to, they've told me that they're coming from all over the states to attend the activities that weekend.
What do, and I really don't know what you call people who are believers or investigators of Sasquatch, Bigfoot, the group that follows that, what do they think of this movie?
Actually, they call them cryptozoologists. And last night I was watching, you know, I've been surfing the internet now trying to go deeper and find everything I can on Boggy Creek that's out there. And I had seen there's a Finding Bigfoot on Animal Planet, had a show with Matthew Moneymaker and the Bigfoot. They're called cryptozoologists. And they all say that this is the movie that inspired them. This is the movie that started their quest. And so I think that when, especially for kids, the people that saw it when they were young, it has an impact today. Rob Lowe, the actor, did a series last year called The Lowe Files, where he was joined with his two sons, and it was kind of a X-Files combined with a Finding Bigfoot or paranormal kind of search. And in one of the first episodes, it's called Bigfoot, and they go to the top of this mountain, and this elder says, "What leads you on this quest?" or something. And he says when he was 8 years old, 7 years old, something, he saw Boggy Creek, and he's been on this quest ever since. And that kind of sums it up. It made a giant impact on a lot of people, and they became intrigued with the subject, and it stuck with them. And some of them actually even make money, you know, working in that field, which that wasn't even talked about. There's an anthropologist, I believe, that they interview in the film, and the word cryptozoology, I don't think, comes up.
Have you ever actually gone out and tried to see or hear it?
No, but I'm going to. I'm going to get my kind of nerves out. I'm a big baby when it comes to mosquitoes and that kind of stuff, but I'll just really. I've been invited on several tours, and the people that are inviting me are like, they know what they're doing and they know where they're going and all that stuff. So yes, at some point I'm going to positively go down there.
You absolutely need to film this and make it part of the bonus reel.
Yeah, that'll be funny. Cause I am my dad. So he started out with bare chuckles and stuff, and he was funny. My dad had a great sense of humor, but his favorite thing to do was to scare people. He got this great thrill out of scaring you. So as a kid, I grew up terrified of everything. You know, I didn't have to go see a movie because my dad was right there to scare us in some way, shape, or form. He would make up stories, or he would tap on something. I mean, just, he was always telling me we'd be going down a mountain. He'd say that the brakes were out or something. You know, so he was always scaring us. So most of my life, I grew up fear. And so after I moved away, it took a long time, but I got over that. So now, like, I'm not afraid, really. I'm not afraid of too much. I have five children now, and so I kind of, not much scares me. And, I'm going to try it. I'm going to go down in the deep, dark. I don't like snakes. That's true. I live in New England, and I moved away because I didn't like the mosquitoes. I didn't like the snakes, and I don't like the humidity. So, but I'll deal with all of those in the swamp.
So you're going to have a premiere on June 14th at the Perot Theater. Can we buy tickets in advance, or is this something that you just get at the door? How's this going to work?
Yes, so what we'll do is we have the premiere at 8 o'clock, and then we'll start additional shows. We'll have a midnight show directly after that, and then we have shows scheduled for all Saturday and Sunday. We'll have meet and greets before the showing. So we'll be signing Macquarie art posters and that kind of stuff. I'm actually going to merchandise. When they released Boggy Creek in 72, merchandising didn't really exist. And I think that the Macquarie image is the iconic Bigfoot image. So we'll be doing posters and all kinds of fun tie-ins that go with that. All those things that I read, those things that fans ask for, I really do. And so I'm going to try to give them those things that make sense and are logistically possible.
Our guest today, Pam Pierce, the daughter of Charles B. Pierce, the creator, director of The Legend of Boggy Creek, which premiered in 1972. I was 10 years old when that movie came out, and I remember scared me. That movie really scared me. I thought the Falk Monster was around every corner for a long time after that. Great movie. I remember the long lines, and I predict the same for the premiere of the restored version, which is going to be on June 14th at the Perot Theater in Texarkana. Pam, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that I get to see you.
Oh, you will. My mother still lives in Ashdown, so I will make it up there for the premiere, and we will get to meet in person. Do you have a website where we can follow the progress of the movie?
We do. We're updating it now, but it is easy enough, legendofboggycreek.com.